She currently teaches at the School of Politics and International Studies of the University of Leeds.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. First of all, I would like to use this opportunity to thank you, the organizers of the Congress, in particular Mr. Jones, for inviting me to speak to you today. Also, I'd like to thank all of you for making a choice in favor of this session and for being open-minded enough to embrace kind of different perspectives. So my talk today is based on a part of my PhD project, which was carried out and supported by the University of Leeds. The material for the talk comes from a variety of sources, but mostly from the several field trips to the affected areas of Belarus, including a trip to the exclusion zone, Belarusian part of the exclusion zone in January 2010. Apart from a map I'm using from one of the 2000 UNSCEAR report, all images used in the presentation are my own. So in my talk, I do not aim to substitute one truth about Chernobyl with another. I do not aim to suggest that I am revealing the ultimate truth about the accident and its consequences for the affected people. Instead, what I'm trying to do is to present a somewhat different perspective and to demonstrate that the ways in which the accident and its consequences were framed had important implications for different groups of affected communities, and also very important implications in terms of assistance offered or withdrawn to them. So the talk will cover several issues. Firstly, I'll just go over some of the figures that characterize the impact of the Chernobyl accident for the country. I will then look at the international consensus regarding the health consequences, in other words, how these consequences were framed and presented, before looking at the implications of these ways of presenting and framing the consequences for both the people and the assistance effort itself. And I will conclude with a call, firstly, not to forget the people affected by this accident, but also, and probably more importantly, to be attentive to their perspective and needs, and to take their perspectives and needs seriously. So just as a reminder, the impact of the accident, we'll just skip to this slide for a moment. So given the geographical proximity to the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, well, that's Belarus, that's a Chernobyl nuclear power plant, given also the prevailing northerly and northwesterly winds, Belarus became one of the countries severely affected by the accident, with 70% of the radioactive fallout that left 23% of its territory with different degree of contamination. So out of all the material released, radioactive iodine was very significant because it was responsible for the rise in the incidence of thyroid cancer. And as far as the radioactive contamination with cesium and strontium is concerned, it was very ununiform, with a majority of impact in the two administrative areas of Belarus, which is Gomel and Mogilev administrative region. So, following the accident, around 25,000 people from 100 villages in Belarus were evacuated from what became the exclusion zone. In this exclusion zone, around 70 villages were buried, and a further 110,000 people were resettled, which made the total of the displaced population around 135,000 people. In the moment, over 1 million people live in the areas which are classed as affected areas, including 500,000 children. And these are large numbers if we talk about the country with the overall population of just under 10 million. In addition, some 110,000 people were recalled as emergency cleanup workers, or most commonly known as liquidators. So from Belarus, we had 110,000 of those. So in the year 2000, the United Nations repeated its call for the accident not to be forgotten, stated all the good reasons why it should be the case. But since the year 2000 onwards, a number of high-level, high-authority international reports have suggested that the consequences of the accident were not as serious as previously anticipated. And in the year 2000, the UN declared, and I quote, that since the majority of the population faced no serious health consequences due to radiation released during the Chernobyl accident, a return to normal life is a realistic prospect for most people living in Chernobyl-affected regions, unquote. So what I'm trying to kind of cover in the following slides is how this kind of the kind of framing of the impact of the accident had an impact for the affected communities and on for the assistance provision. And obviously, the impact was framed in a variety of ways. This slide refers to the what I call the psychologization of the impact of the Chernobyl accident. We have some good examples here suggesting that what we have as the main impact is in fact mental health issue. So mental health impact was the largest consequence for the people. So this framing can be viewed, I suggest, as problematic, especially when it was also accompanied by the rhetorical strategy of blaming the victims. When it was suggested that what people were experiencing was largely brought onto by themselves through engagement in risky behavior, such as foraging for wild foods, through smoking and drinking, through not following the guidelines that they were given. So why is this framing problematic? Well, I suggest it's problematic because it's implied that people affected by the accident, the big numbers of them, were unusually fearful, irrational, ignorant, that something was wrong with the way that they responded to these kind of shocks. And also, if fear of radiation was perceived to be the main problem, then the only solution that should be available is the accurate information. So if people are concerned, it means that they suffer from mental health problems that need to be rectified. Another way in which the situation was framed is that of what I call normalization. So with an awful lot of emphasis on the return to normality. Obviously, return to normality is what we all want for following any accident, and is what the people in the affected regions also want. But it raises a number of questions as to what can be considered normal under the circumstances, given that the return to pre-accident conditions is hardly ever possible, given all the kind of complexity of its impact. So shall we be talking instead about some kind of new normality, or adapting and accepting a new normality rather than returning to normal? Because I think it's at least disingenuous, and I think it also can be considered as some kind of cruel. Also, that is not how people perceive their situation at all. Their views as presented here, you can see they are far from saying that everything is normal and what they experience is a normality. So in terms of implications of the ways that the accident was framed, I suggest we need to try and trace what are called the Chernobyl ghosts. Chernobyl ghosts is a category of people who were made invisible in a number of ways. They're invisible because they might not be there where they used to live for a variety of reasons. But they also can be invisible because their health effects are not officially linked to the accident. Or even if they're linked to the accident, their numbers are statistically insignificant. Or if their effects are actually accounted for statistically, all we see is numbers. All we experience is an aggregate phenomenon, which obviously erases all individual stories and also in a lot of instances of suffering. So these two images were taken from one of the abandoned villages, abandoned village of Babchin in the Belarusian exclusion zone. In Belarus, the exclusion zone is now occupied by the Polesky State Radiological and Ecological Reserve. So this particular village was not buried like many others under similar circumstances, so it's still there, still meets the visitors, rare visitors with reproach. And it's a very difficult experience of visiting this kind of ghost villages. But I think the most appropriate here is to use some of the testimonies of cleanup workers that I interviewed who were there following the accident. And that's something that they had to say, and I'd like to quote. People were given 3 hours to leave their village. They took their cows to the collective farm, but the cows broke through the farm gates and each of them was running home howling. People couldn't take anything with them, neither dogs nor cows, and animals could feel that, and it was scary, unquote. We saw those resettled villages, empty houses with gardens full with apples that were fallen and rotting. It created an awful impression, as if everything had died out, had died, unquote. It was depressing. Abandoned dogs and cats, allotments not tended to, everything overgrown. One couldn't even pass through for the branches of cherry, pear, and plum trees. Everything had gone wild. That's how it was like there, unquote. So at this particular testimony is demonstrated, it was a very difficult and traumatic experience for the cleanup workers themselves. But obviously we shouldn't forget about the traumatic experience for the people who had to live there, for homes on a very short notice with not very much information to face the unknown, because they were not told if they would be coming back at all. And in fact, as I was told by a former leader of the local council, some of the resettlements took place in stages, with people being moved sometimes from the 10-kilometer zone to the 30-kilometer zone without being told what was going to happen to them. So many of them believed that they would be coming back, and to see them realize that that was not a possibility was absolutely heartbreaking. So some of the areas affected in Belarus also happened to be some of the most productive agricultural areas, but also areas of outstanding national beauty. So that obviously had a bigger impact, or kind of had an important factor for those who had to be evacuated and resettled. But what I'd like to talk a little bit more now is the invisibility of suffering, different kind of invisibility, not because people were physically moved from a particular area. And a good example comes from the story of thyroid cancer survivors. Thyroid cancer remains one of the very few conditions to which the causal link with Chernobyl accident was established, although the process of establishing such a link was not straightforward. But the fact that people in question only had thyroid cancer, which is rarely fatal and also generally curable, renders their suffering invisible. That many of these people had their thyroid glands partly or fully removed, that they have to keep on taking medication for the duration of their lives, that they will bear scars, also known as Belarusian necklace, that many of them were children or adolescents when they had to have this experience, somehow matters much less. So one of the instances, very few instances of recognition of the wider implication of thyroid cancer is recognition of its impact in economic terms, something that can be found in a number of UNDP reports. Also recently, WHO, World Health Organization, drew attention to the complications and difficulties of treatment in terms of side and after effects. But still, wider implications of this, as I said, social and psychological impact remain unexamined. So we also had an almost exclusive focus on children, which rendered the suffering of those who were exposed as adults and also developed thyroid cancer completely invisible. And finally, recognition of thyroid cancer as caused by radiation was never followed by recognition of causal links with any other conditions. So in Belarusian case, as scholar Kuczynska observes, and I quote, "Thyroid has become a common reference for Chernobyl problems to the exclusion of anything else." Unquote. So what I'd like to talk about now is some of the implications for the assistance effort. So not directly in terms of people themselves, but what they were offered. And the implications were quite serious. As I was saying, because it was recognized that the biggest impact of the accident had to do with the mental health issues, and also because a lot of the citizens or inhabitants of the affected territories were recognized as being suffering from the Chernobyl victim syndrome, or it was called Chernobyl dependency syndrome. Therefore, the provision of information was made a priority. So, interestingly, one of the very few needs assessments that were carried out in Belarus. This particular one was carried out by a host of agencies under the auspices of the UNDP in 2004. That needs assessment found out that lack information was not something that worried people and not something that was a priority for them. For instance, over 74% cited health concerns as being a much bigger issue. Low living standards, over half of them. Radioactive contamination, 22%. Lack of employment, 15%. And the cancellation of benefits and compensation, 12%. Neither did they suggest that what they needed was more reliable information. They were calling for such measures as healthcare improvement, almost 70%, decontamination, 21%, and also appointment of knowledgeable people at local leaders, job creation, and new research. What they were given, though, was the new fantastic network, very important. I don't want to kind of belittle the achievements there. But there was no emphasis on new research. Was an emphasis on distributing information so that the behavior and fatalistic attitudes could be overcome, so that whatever misconceptions people had in their minds could be alleviated. This also had to do with the view that to combat the Chernobyl victim dependency syndrome, interventions were needed aimed at transforming passive, dependent, and fatalistic people into active and entrepreneurial individuals and resilient and self-reliant communities. And we can have masses of examples from a number of high-level international reports saying just that. And there's nothing wrong with this kind of statements and pronouncements. And obviously, everybody would want empowerment of the affected communities and their abilities to cope better with the consequences. But when we make this kind of pronouncements with the knowledge that opportunities for people to influence their lives are extremely limited, what I suggest we can better understand this situation as the negative responsabilization, which is transfer of responsibility without transferring any capacity or ability to actually take this responsibility on. So furthermore, a number of influential reports criticized the authorities of the affected countries, of the three most affected Soviet republics, for excessive benefit systems, for excessive health interventions, and suggested that this program should be scaled down and areas excluded from economic use should be reduced. A good example comes from the 2008 UN Action Plan on Chernobyl, which criticized the national efforts as excessive, as creating the dependency syndrome, and suggested that instead what was required, and I quote, a restored sense of community self-reliance, unquote. So I suggest that all these ways of framing the accident and what should be done to address it had a very important implication for the assistance effort, for what people received or rather not received. So these are some of the points that I want to conclude with or to bring to your attention at the end. But also, as I mentioned at the start, the message of my intervention is not to forget these people, because there are very good reasons not to, and because we owe them that much. The message is also not to dismiss, exclude, or marginalize their perspectives, but to actively seek and listen to them. And I'd like to also refer to one of the great comments made by the chair in the previous session about the stakeholders' engagement. I think it's a wider issue here. If we are serious about democracy and democratic principles of transparency, accountability, and participation, we should not be paying just lip service to these principles. We should actually take them seriously. We should not dismiss these people as irrational, ignorant, incapable, and helpless. We should actually allow them to be heard, allow them to voice whatever concerns they have, to explain so that they would, if there's something that they actually don't understand, but to really take them seriously. And I think if we do so, there'll be more of them speaking to you today instead of me. So my message finally is not to seek easy answers and simple closures. is to support the continued research and continued attention to the issue of the consequences of this accident, but also to appreciate the power behind and the implication of what we say, of our assessments, evaluations, and pronouncements, because that is something that affects very much the people and their ability to protect themselves. We should not try to make sure we do not negatively affect the ability of people to protect themselves and their families, and also to receive the necessary assistance to that end. So thank you very much for your attention.